You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to what may be the most historically significant episode of The Brian Callen Show. In fact, I'm going to go so far as to say perhaps the most historically significant podcast of all time, because this is the podcast where we finally kill political correctness. Political correctness had a really good run, and we totally understand why it happened. You know, we tried to talk about each other's culture, and it didn't really go well for a few thousand years. But thanks to these two men, we're now going to have a productive conversation about which cultures are more adaptive than other cultures. And that's the crucial word. We're not saying that cultures are better. We're just saying that they're better suited to certain environments. Well, you know, I don't know whether we'll edit that out. I kind of like that in there, because that is really the result of a more adaptive culture, a culture which is able capable of producing innovations like the iPhone. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Joseph Henrich and Professor Richard Nisbet. We've had both of them on the show before. Professor Henrich is the author of a book called The Secret of Our Success, which is, you know, a look at culture from the perspective of evolution. And then Professor Nisbet has written many books and taken a look at, for example, why the South is more violent, a result of an honor culture, you know, intelligence and how to get it. And then, you know, another book called The Geography of Thought, where we look at the differences in mindset between the sort of Eastern Confucian way of thinking and the Western Aristotelian way of thinking. So without further ado, I'm going to step back and let the two really smart guys in the room talk.
What are we supposed to talk about, Joe? What
I can think of so many things.
Well, the first thing
like
is,
start, Hunter?
I would say the first thing, right, is that, you know, there are good reasons why political correctness happened as a sort of moment in time, right? A lot of the cultures of conversations about culture were not particularly productive.
Okay, well, I can key off that quite well. I realized about 25 years ago that the scientific methods that social psychologists had developed were capable of studying culture in a scientific way. I was very excited about that. I decided I would go into cultural psychology, which was not really a field at that time. But this was like 1990-92, the absolute peak of political correctness. So I said, well, how can I ease my way into this? I actually know something bad about white males, which is that in the South, they're more likely to kill each other than in the North. And when I started that, it was I found quickly that that's actually true. Trying to show that there are cultural reasons for it was a great deal of fun, and I believe is more or less accepted as a solution, and that is that hurting peoples worldwide are tough guys. And they're tough guys because they can lose their livelihood in an instant. You can take all my pigs, you can let down the bars on my corral, I'm finished. So I'm going to make it perfectly clear to you that you better not mess with me. Any hint of aggression, even an insult, and I'll respond with violence at the threat of it. This is a perfectly good adaptation, and it makes it quite clear why the homicide rate in the South, that is to say, the homicide rate in the South where an insult is involved, as in a love triangle or neighbor's quarrel or fight in the bar, those kinds of insult-related murders are much higher in the South, but not so-called instrumental murders, 7-Eleven murders, where somebody shoots the guy behind the counter. Those are actually slightly higher in the North. So, at any rate, I did that work. I was frightened at first of saying, oh, boy, you know, that Southerners would be upset by it. Southerners were delighted with it, as a matter of fact. I only got called on the carpet by Northerners who were saying these terrible things about Southerners, which in fact they regarded as more complimentary than otherwise.
And in case anybody hasn't picked up on it, but when you said white men, you are yourself a Southerner.
Well, it's a Southwesterner. I'm from El Paso.
So as a Texan, which may or may not be part of the South or may or may not be its own separate thing, you, in some sense, because a lot of this, right, is that there's always, anytime anybody starts to talk about culture, it's like, who are you to talk about this? Like, we're allowed to talk about our own groups, you know, but we're certainly not allowed to talk about other groups' culture.
Right. And I can tell a story about that, too, but let's let Joe talk.
Well, I mean, I think a big insight from a lot of this work is that, you know, when you grow up in a society, you acquire a lot of things about that society and you come to appreciate the traditions and these things become internalized motivations. It shapes your brain. It shapes our hormonal systems as some of Dick and Dove's work shows. So a lot of times when you present this back to the people who you've studied, I've had this experience, they can be quite proud of it. It doesn't sound strange or insulting to them. And in some cases, they'll be quite proud of it, or they'll just accept it as a fact about how life is here. I had this experience in Peru with the Machiganga and in rural southern Chile with the Mapuche, and also in the South Pacific with the Fijians I've been studying for the last 10 years. Of course, one thing I wanted to point out about the political correctness and the sort of adaptiveness idea, that adaptiveness varies across societies, is that, of course, we're not talking about things like happiness. So where I work in the South Pacific, the Fijians are probably the happiest people I've ever met. So there's a lot of dimensions of culture that you might be interested in how they vary besides just the adaptiveness of societies.
Well, and I mean, for example, you know, one of the things that is covered in Sapiens, right, is that, you know, the rise of agriculture was a really, really good evolution in terms of, you know, having perhaps a more reliable food supply. But in terms of happiness, it destroyed a lot of the basic sources of happiness. So technological progress does not necessarily fit with other dimensions of life, like you're talking about, like happiness or dignity, or there's much more income disparity, for example, in a modern industrial society than there is in, for example, a hunter-gatherer tribe.
Right. And with agriculture, at least in the beginning, the health went down quite a bit too. People became smaller, frailer. They suffered a whole bunch of new disease conditions. And it's only when with the rise of modern societies since the demographic transition that we've really fully gotten away from the being less healthy than hunter-gatherers were, for example, in the Paleolithic.
Yeah, agriculture also invented dentistry, right? Because, you know, agricultural people have much, much worse teeth, right? Because of the combination of the, you know, the free carbs and, you know, grains, but also because of grinding corn, you end up with little stones in there, and then people chew on those stones, and that turns out to not be great for teeth.
Well, that's maybe an opportunity for me to talk about when I began to do research on people who weren't like me. About 25 years ago, again, 20 years ago, a brilliant student from China started working with me. And after I knew him for a while, he says, you know, Dick, you and I think completely differently. And I said, oh, well, tell me more. And this is something like the story that he told. I mean, it's which we amplified over the years. He said, you have a very analytic mind. You look at some kind of object or a person or something that you want to achieve some goal with respect to, and you categorize it and you think of what rules apply to those categories. You're constantly making a mental model of the world in this way. Chinese, and we now know practically everybody else in the world other than Western European, people of Western European culture, are much more likely to view the world holistically. So they're looking at every object, every person in its context, and they see relationships, and they're attuned to similarities. Completely different way of constructing the world. And we have our most impressive finding, I think, is if you show underwater scenes to Westerners and Japanese, the Westerner will tell you, I saw, you show them these animated clips and then you ask them, what did you see? The Westerner will say, well, I saw three big fish swimming off to the left. They had pink stipples on their bellies. The Japanese will overwhelmingly start with context. They'll say, I saw a stream. The water was green. There were rocks and shells on the bottom. There were three big fish swimming off to the left. They actually are able to report 60% more context when I ask them what they saw than the Americans were. And they see twice as many relationships between the object and the context. And when we go to the eye movement data, we just look at where they're looking. It's the East Asians are looking back and forth from the object to the context, whereas the eye movements are of the Americans are focused right around that object.
So, Dick, are you saying that East Asians are shifty-eyed?
Well, yeah, in this sense, I mean, they're taking in the world more.
We really get this picture that, you know, the way that Westerners think is odd, or, you know, I mean, to dovetail with Professor Henrik's work, right, that they are weird, right? And so, Professor Henrik, you found that there's, you know, the sort of people that usually get studied in psych studies or, you know, college undergraduates, and that they are not psychologically like the vast majority of people. Is that correct?
Yeah, so two colleagues and I at the University of British Columbia, Steve Heine and R. Noren Zion, compiled all the data we could find from different societies where there were multiple cases where the same psychological protocols were run in different places. And what we found in domain after domain, from perceptual domains to memory domains to domains about moral judgment, measurements of fairness, of impersonal trust, of willingness to cooperate, of willingness to punish non-cooperators, the Western subjects were at the far end of the distribution, anchoring the distribution. And of course, there was lots of other cultural variation besides the West versus the rest difference. But the subjects most commonly studied by psychologists, and at least at that time behavioral economists, were particularly unusual from a global perspective.
But so, you know, and I mean, to connect back to the geography of thought, Dick's book, you know, these very particular circumstances that existed in Europe meant that it was more adaptive to think in this sort of very individualistic way. Right. You know, you have, like, if we think about the Greeks, you know, they really are looking after their own small holding farms, and then they go into the agora and they all argue with each other. Right.
Yeah. And well, that's the story that I like to tell about why it is that you would get these different kinds of cognitive styles. The people who are involved in agriculture, especially rice agriculture, have to get along with one another. They have to coordinate their behavior or they're in big trouble. And this creates a social environment where you have to pay attention to other people. You're constantly looking at context. You're not your own person. You're a cog in the machine. Incidentally, you can show these differences between Westerners and Easterners just by asking them to draw a little sociogram, that is, draw a circle representing yourself and circles representing your closest acquaintances, and then draw lines among them, show who's connected to whom. Americans draw great big circles and put themselves in the middle of everything.
Which is the truth, right?
What's that?
That's the truth, right?
Yeah, that's the way they perceive it. Japanese draw circles that are typically no larger than and often smaller than the circles for other people, and they're just as likely to put themselves off to the side in that. So, and as you started with the point of why would Greeks be different from the heavily agricultural regions, and I think it's because you can't do large-scale agriculture in Greece. Greece's ecology is mountains descending to the sea, and what you can do in those circumstances are herding and fishing and trading, occupations that don't require so much coordination with other people in order to be successful. So they had the luxury of attending to the objects they wanted to influence, and not paying that much attention to what other people wanted. So the cognitive differences derive from the social differences, which in turn derive from the economic base difference. One very neat wrinkle on that suggests that the agricultural thesis is correct is that within China there are fairly large differences. Mm-hmm. Northern China is mostly wheat agriculture, which isn't so intensively social as rice agriculture. Which they have in the south, and sure enough, northern Chinese are more analytic in our various cognitive and perceptual tests than the southern rice-growing Chinese.
But so we have these agricultural, you've got the herding cultures and they develop this real macho honor culture, right? You have these smallholder farmers, in ancient Greece who, develop this, is useful in that context, but has obviously ramifications over the next hundreds, thousands of years that lead to things like science. And then you have this very sort of holistic mindset that develops from rice agriculture as a response to that, that then again has these huge cultural ramifications. And, I think what's interesting is that, it's not clear how an honor-based culture is really helpful in the modern world. But the Greek outlook and the Chinese outlook, they just seem to have different outcomes. So that the descendants of Aristotle end up being very good at scientific innovation, but then these East Asian cultures, these very holistic views, end up being very good engineers.
So I'd like to jump in. I think the point that Dick made, there's an intervening variable or factor here that is crucial, which is that the ecological factors operate through their effects on social organization, social structure. And most human societies have been organized around kinship. So there are these large kin-based institutions. So in China, for example, that variation that you find with rice agriculture correlates with the intensity of clans. So in China, you have corporate clans where everybody's a member of a clan, you're responsible for the other members of your clan. So it's really the social organization and the institutions of the society that are affecting the social psychology, the cognition, the memory, the perception, all of those downstream psychological effects. So what's interesting in Europe is that the family structures get dismantled by the spread of the Catholic Church. The church has what I call the marriage and family program, which it begins spreading sometime around the 4th century of the Common Era. And missionaries are sent out and they're dismantling, no polygyny, no clans, no complex kinship units, no corporate-based ownership. All that kind of stuff gets dismantled by these Christian missionaries that are spreading all over Europe. So
why did they do that?
Europe is actually transformed by this peculiar religion that decides it doesn't like certain kinds of complex kinship structures.
Why didn't the Catholic Church like complex kin structures?
Well, Fukuyama answers that question. He says that it was a play by the Catholic Church to get wealth. Because what happened when you had these complex clan structures is that people would pass all their wealth onto second and third cousins. And when you when women become able to inherit property, which is something that the Catholic Church brought in, then they had the potential to be able to leave that money to the church in the form of lands and wealth. So, the great irony that comes out of that, and I think that's in The Origins of Political Order, the first book by Fukuyama, is that, the strength of the West actually comes from the destruction of the family by the church to have this sort of very limited nuclear family rather than these extended clan structures that you find in places like, well, most of the world.
Right.
Professorial clarification. So Fukuyama gets that idea from the anthropologist Jack Goody.
Mm-hmm. I would believe it, but I only listen. Occasionally, I end up going back to the primary sources. But it is, that is a really good point. I remember, you know, reading Guns, Germs, and Steel and just being, thinking Jared Diamond. I mean, I read it, you know, right before my freshman year of college and was like, Jared Diamond is a genius. How did he know all these things? But you find out that, you know, he's drawing strongly on the work of people like Crosby and various other people.
Right.
And there is, I mean, that's the thing. And I think that's the process that I think a lot of, and this really goes to your book, Joe, The Secret of Our Success, is that people don't see that a lot of these innovations really are the result of synthesizing lots and lots and lots of earlier innovations into some new form.
Right. And so one of the things that this marriage and family program did is it, you know, a big thing was no cousin marriage, no sort of endogamous marrying within your kin group or marrying relatives. So it forced people to go out and seek and make new connections. Mm-hmm. And this led to the emergence of charter towns and the more formation of voluntary institutions. So it really drove the kind of secular institutions that now allow modern societies to operate.
But again, for anybody who's out there listening, it's important to recognize that the success of the West is the destruction of the family by the church, which, you know, I mean, it's pretty odd, right? That's certainly right. Not the narrative that the right tries to advance. But anyway, you know, there was an interesting little thought for me, or maybe not. But the so what we're seeing is we're seeing that these, you know, these cultures evolve. They evolve over long times. You know, they have ramifications that we couldn't have predicted. So the Catholic Church, you know, does these very strange things with the family structure that then lead to more societal mixing, you know, ultimately lead to secular institutions, which then have this blowback on the Catholic Church itself. Or, you know, you have these smallholder farmers who are just sort of evolving the structure that is agriculturally most adaptive, but then it leads to logic. So there's this process by which cultures are developing and then they're surviving into environments, because we are so tribal and groupish, where they don't necessarily make sense anymore.
Right. Well, Westerners and the rest of the world don't understand each other well on precisely this kind of issue. We don't realize the extent, we Westerners don't realize the extent to which most people regard themselves as being like ropes in a net of the network of people that they are associated with and that they are tied to. And we are puzzled by any number of things that characterize these different societies. For example, it's apparently common in Chinese business that if there is no relative to take over a company after the departure or death of the head of the company, they will adopt someone who will now be the head of the company, because you really couldn't trust anybody who wasn't a family member. That's extreme, but the Westerner makes very little distinction between in-group members and out-group members as compared to Easterners and Arabs and most other people other than the weird people that that Joe talks about. So if you have a situation where people are making judgments and some people are making an incorrect judgment from time to time, and you see whether a poor subject who's watching this is influenced by these people who are making the wrong judgments and makes the wrong judgment himself or herself, you find that in-group members or out-group members, it doesn't matter for Americans. They're equally influenced by both. But there's a huge difference for Easterners. They're much more influenced by in-group members and hardly influenced at all by out-group members. It's just a different kind of categorization. There's my folks. I mean, there's an expression in Arabic, I think. Me against my brother and me against my uncle and cousin, my uncles and cousin against, you know, and so on. It's just there are circles within circles within circles, and we just, I mean, in the West, we just don't have that kind of structure. It's,
yeah, and it's strange. I mean, you know, my parents lived in the Middle East for a long time, you know, and when they lived in Libya, on Friday, you would go over for family dinner, and, like, everybody had to stop by, and they knew who their second, third, fourth cousins were. They were able to track these huge extended clans that, you know, I mean, we just, I mean, as a Westerner, you're like, I know who my uncles and my first cousins are, and that's it.
Yeah, my good friend, Lee Ross, I'm sure you know him, Joe, he's Jewish, and he once said, you know, Dick, a difference between you and me is that it matters to me what my great uncles think of me. And I'll bet you don't even know who your great uncles are. True enough, I didn't have a clue.
But I think the corollary to that is that the, you know, the West not only doesn't understand the rest of the world, we also don't understand ourselves. We have this very unrealistic view of ourselves as rational individuals, you know, and there's been this real rebellion against Homo economicus, the idea that human beings are rational actors. And we have, you know, in that sense, you know, we have far more in common with hunter-gatherers than we would realize.
Yeah, well, there are cognitive tests, and Joe can speak to this better than I can, where hunter-gatherers look more like modern industrial people than either does, by comparison to large-scale agriculture people. Hmm. That's right, isn't it, basically?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So, you know, the measures of field dependence and field independence, there's this pattern where the hunter-gatherers, at least if they're mobile, if they're sedentary, it doesn't apply, but if they're mobile, then they look more like Westerners. So what I think, I mean, my view on this is that as you had sedentary agriculture, you built up these increasingly intensive kin-based institutions, the one in which yourself becomes at the center of a web, and you see yourself in terms of your role in this larger network of kin relations where you're keeping track of all these different people. But if you're mobile foragers, it's much more fluid. You're going to have friends in lots of different places. So it's just more like the high residential and relational mobility that we find amongst Westerners, especially Americans.
Right.
So
a different area code every 5 years.
So I mean that's the interesting thing. So now we arrive at a period in history where we, you know, I mean, thanks to people like you, we are now starting to understand that, you know, culture is a tool. It's a very powerful tool, and that, you know, some cultures are adaptive to certain environments and some cultures aren't. So do we now enter a stage in human history where hopefully we're a little more intentional about designing what cultures are, you know, useful and going to serve us both as individuals and as a society?
You know, there's a quote I love from Daniel Moynihan, a senator from New York, who once said, "The great conservative truth is that societies rise or fall based on their cultures. The great liberal truth is that cultures can change themselves."
Right.
And so hopefully now we enter that period, right?
Well, I'm hoping. So I discussed this a little bit in the last chapter of my book. I think, you know, we're really just beginning to get to the point where the social science can really help us do kind of active design instruction. One of the things I've kind of that I push for a little bit at the end of the book is that we need to take a kind of more Darwinian approach to this, of kind of variation and selection. So to create kind of natural labs, a bunch of different towns try a different approach to solving some public good problem, and then we see which towns do better, which towns do worse, and then you can disseminate the best practices. But our ability to rationally figure out what the best practices is seems limited. It seems like when we try to do that, there's often some unintended consequence and things go wrong. So what we need is to design figuring that we're not actually that good at figuring this stuff out, but we can use variation selection systems to get to the best answers.
I don't know that's universally true. I mean, there, you know, I shouldn't disagree with, you know, either of you, but I know from my own work in terms of tutoring and education, there are certain things that rationally we know that are values that we've known for a long time, but that just aren't consistently applied. I mean, a good example is simply embracing mistakes and analyzing them and using them to get better, which, you know...
Embracing what?
Embracing mistakes. I mean, if you look, like, if you take, you know, the cornerstone of education is figure out what you don't know or what you got wrong, and then use that to improve. And if you look at what most students do, for example, with their tests, they'll get the test back, they'll look at the grade on the top, and then they'll pitch it, especially if they don't like what the grade was. But, you know, what we should do and what we know from the work on deliberate practice, you know, what we know from cultures that are effective about really embracing and analyzing mistakes is that students should go through and look at each question that they got wrong, figure out what went wrong, and then, you know, clarify the rules. Do they need to write more working? Do they need to check their work? What is the thing that is procedurally going to allow them to get consistently better and better and better results? And, you know, that's what the FAA has done. I mean, there are certain values like that that I think that, you know, we can say fairly definitively and fairly rationally should be applied across all cultures. I can't see any downside to that.
Yeah, no, I understand. So in that case, the challenge is the dissemination. So how do we get the practice adopted, given that the current incentive structures don't favor it, or that people just don't see it as useful?
Well, I think that, I mean, this is again where your book comes in, because, I mean, and you know, so the homo economicus idea is we just dispense a bunch of facts and that changes behavior, but it doesn't change
right.
Behavior. We know that. And, you know, I mean, I thought that what you were saying about imitation in The Secret of Success, and specifically imitating, you know, high status individuals, is really, really key. And I think if you wouldn't mind dilating on that and telling us a bit more about that, I think that's really the key.
Sure. So one of the lines of my research is trying to figure out the nature of human cultural learning. So how do we figure out who in our social milieu to pay attention to, or how do we integrate information that's coming from different sources? And so one of the things that we see in young children all the way up through adults is a tendency to key in on certain members according to cues of prestige, so who other people defer to, cues of success. But we also use other kinds of cues, like who speaks our language in a similar way, so cues of language or dialect, things like ethnic markers, who dresses like us, also self-similarity. So males tend to copy males, females tend to copy females. And so once you understand what all these different cues are, you can customize depending on what kind of population you want to hit. You know, you don't send someone in who's ethnically very different to convince a bunch of people to do someone if he's not thought to be locally prestigious, if he's not kind of an in-group member of that, of whatever group you're trying to convince.
And the work on the diffusion of innovations all backs that up. I mean, the classic book on this is Everett Rogers' The Diffusion of Innovations.
Right.
And, you know, one of the stories that he tells in the very beginning of the book is, you know, this healthcare worker comes into this remote Andean village and tries to convince people to boil their water, convince the women to do that. And it's a disaster, right? And, you know, I mean, we are like, oh, they're so irrational. But if you think about it, you know, woman comes in, says, there are these tiny invisible creatures in your water that will make you sick. But if you boil them and then let the water cool down, magically these little demons go away. And it doesn't. It sounds mythological, and in reality, like in terms of what you're saying, like, you know, people like to think, oh, my beliefs in, you know, hand washing and, you know, boiling my water or whatever are rational, but we have just sort of internalized those norms from the society, and they're adaptive and they work, and so they persist.
Well, right. And so one of my big points is that, you know, we're really fundamentally cultural learners in the sense that there's way too much in our world for us to kind of rationally pick all of our beliefs and practices and stuff based on evidence we get from the world. So we're really well equipped to drinking in and believing deeply in all kinds of beliefs, you know, as we're exposed to members of our family and the larger community who themselves deeply believe it. And so all this stuff gets built in very quickly and at a young age often. And then you just carry it around and, you know, you end up with all kinds of superstitions, you end up with religions, but then there's all these kinds of subtle practices like the ones you're thinking of that are hard to shake as a consequence.
Well, as a social psychologist, one of the things that fascinates me most about these issues that we've just been talking about is that everybody is highly susceptible to social influence, some from different sources, possibly, but Easterners are quite well aware of these social influences on them. They know perfectly well that they're doing things because other people are doing them. Westerners, who are much more individualistic, and certainly they like to think of themselves as individualistic, are unaware to an astonishing extent of the degree to which they are affected by the behavior of others. In a book I just wrote called Mind, where I started off with this social influence idea, making fun of myself. I said, you know, many years ago I bought a Saab and an automobile, And I noticed, interesting, a lot of people here in town have shallops. And I took up cross-country skiing, and after a while, gosh, everybody's out on the slopes. And after a while, I sort of lost interest in cross-country skiing, and I noticed, nobody else is doing it either. there was this feeling that I was making these choices simply by responding to situations in the world, when really I'm doing all these things because everybody else is doing them, or a lot of people that I identify with. That would be less likely for an Easterner. Easterners would be more aware of the extent to which they're doing things because that's what other people do.
And that's one of those pieces of Western arrogance, right? We're always like, God, Asians are so faddish. They, you know, if you like get with them, if you get a product going there, then they'll all copy it. And the reality is that we're all faddish. We all copy the practices of the people who we respect. It's just that Asians are much more honest about it. And, you know, Westerners live in this delusion that, oh, we independently, rationally came to the conclusion that Air Jordans are cool.
Right. Yeah, one of the fun games my old friend, the psychologist Steve Hine, and I used to play was, what would psychology look like if it had been invented in Japan or China? Because
mm-hmm.
Psychologists are very interested, for example, in conformity, right? It fascinates them that people will go along with people on, say, the Ash conformity test, where you have to guess the length of these lines, and people will guess an obviously wrong line if two other people before them have guessed the length of the line, guessed a different line that's not the right length. And, most other people in the world, that would not be surprising at all. And so it wouldn't have become one of the canonical experiments in the discipline. The same thing with our fascination with these violations of normative rationality. You have to think that people are rational before violations of normative rationality become interesting.
That is really funny. To go back to the Everett Rogers point, as he said that, you know, what this healthcare worker should have done is gone into the village, identified the three coolest women in the village, and you get them to boil the water by whatever means it takes to get them to boil the water, and then the entire village will copy them.
And there's economists are actually running kind of naturalistic experiments now that support that, where they actually try to transmit things like microfinance through social networks.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's the thing is if you know, it's even the thing like embracing mistakes. I mean, you look, there's a whole bunch of people who have sort of internalized. I mean, Silicon Valley does that, or at least talks about that. And I mean, I think they do to some extent. And, you know, there's a bunch of people who have become sort of Silicon Valley groupies and who have really like started emulating that culture and emulating all parts of it. And I think it's the same thing. If you got, you know, whoever the elite people were in any group to really be talking about embracing mistakes, that's so important. Let's analyze our mistakes. Let's learn from them. Then you would find a whole bunch of social copying. But I think what's interesting about this is that, you know, the old model, sort of the way that we used to think in the 60s, is we need to disseminate lots of facts to everyone, engage in lots of education. But really, it's about isolating those change agents, convincing that small number of change agents, and then really get it, and then everybody else will copy.
Yeah, I mean, another technique is a lot of times people are ignorant of how common a certain belief might be. Like a whole bunch of people might believe, well, it's a bad idea, but they don't say it because they think the majority doesn't agree with them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can figure that out, then you can take advantage of that and just say, actually, most people around here believe this.
Mm-hmm.
And then people will conform to the majority because they didn't previously realize that it was a majoritarian view and said that they're willing to go along with it. So that's another kind of technique you can use once you understand the psychology.
And I think you're seeing as well that, like, with the internet, there are certain beliefs that the sort of the hive mind is really, really good at changing, right? So, you know, the whole body image thing, that's something that people love to talk about. Bullying is another one that is really being dealt with. I mean, you know, Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, talks about how social norms around violence have really changed over time, and that has, you know, led to a massive decrease of violence. But there are other beliefs that we're less good at dealing with and less good at addressing. So there seems to be an asymmetry in terms of the kind of cultural beliefs that we're good at changing.
Right. Yep.
But so I think, yeah, the large conclusion is that, and this is part of why I wanted to, you know, I think that you guys have there's such a complementarity between your books, and I would really recommend for listeners to, you know, get both you know, Dick's books and also Joe's books, The Secret of Our Success, and then, you know, Mindware, The Geography of Thought, you know, Culture of Honor, Intelligence and How to Get It. Because the, you know, Joe, you're really looking at this from a real evolutionary standpoint. I mean, you know, looking at, you know, how are we different from chimps? How are we different from orangutans? And then, you know, for Professor Nisbet, we're really seeing these sort of large, potentially lightning rod topics, you know, like cultures of honor and the differences in East-West thought be broken down and looked at in a very thoughtful, sensitive, and empirical way.
Well, one thing, get back to the political correctness thing. I was scared about presenting my work on Southern Culture of Honor. I thought I was going to get jumped on. I hardly ever got jumped on, even by the most politically correct of Northerners. And I was really scared when I started doing the Asian stuff. Oh, my God, you know, how dare I, as a white man, say how those folks think. It helps. I learned always to start my talks by saying, I had this brilliant Chinese student.
Yeah.
So I worked alongside him and showed that he was right. And it's actually, that has the virtue of being true, as well as being a good defense. But people listen to this stuff. If you've got the facts, I mean, if you've got unshakable facts, people are interested and they're not going to attack you. I mean, I must say that the cultural differences that I look at, and I would love to hear Joe comment on this, I'll often look at a culture from the outside and say, God, they're idiots to do that. You know, Southerners are idiots. They're killing each other all the time. Well, you get to look at, oh, there's a reason for that, a solid reason for why they're that way. Of course, they shouldn't continue to be that way, but as a stance, it was once a completely rational stance. And you can show with so-called agent-based modeling that you'll always get an honor-based culture under certain circumstances. Basically, when the police are not around where you have to defend yourself, it's going to quickly devolve into a culture of honor kind of situation. And then on the East-West differences, I'm saying Westerners are analytic, and we think that's great. And a lot of Westerners, if you told them they're thinking holistically, they would be insulted. I mean, holistic, that's all this fuzzy-wuzzy stuff. But in fact, as I've studied these cognitive differences more and more, I've gotten more and more convinced that there are tremendous advantages to having a holistic view of the world. They're very similar to ones that were identified by developmental psychologists about 30 years ago, reacting to Jean Piaget's notion of formal thinking, logic-based thinking. They're saying, well, there's a whole different way of thinking about things that is wise, that will help you get good solutions. For example, taking the perspectives of as many people as you can, recognizing that situations are fluid and can change, looking for opportunities to reduce conflict with other people, not being so certain because you're aware of change. You're not so certain in your predictions about the world or in your judgments. And in fact, we find that looking at social conflict, we give people literally Dear Abby columns about, you know, a fight that I'm having with my brother-in-law. What should I do? And young Japanese are much wiser. And not just by a jury of their peers. I mean, we find Westerners who are interested in social conflict grade the young Japanese answers as being wiser than the young Americans. This is Americans saying they do it better than we do. But interestingly, Japanese don't get wiser as they get older with respect to how to deal with social conflict. And Americans do, and I think that's because we're not taught about how to avoid social conflict. We don't live in a world, a holistic world, social orientation towards other people, so we're constantly stepping at it and making messes. So we have to induce ways of avoiding conflict and reducing it when it happens. Then, by the time they're 70, there's no difference between Japanese and Americans, but Japanese get there first.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. So there's lots of ways in which we can take advantage of the kind of lessons learned from different societies and kind of bring them together, back to the recombination to create innovation. So when I was thinking about this question, I'm part ethnographer, right? So I go to societies and I spend a long time there, many months or years. And I find two things that are relevant here. One is you can really start to kind of empathize with people and understand their decision making and why they're doing it. And I'm always surprised at how quickly it starts to feel right to you. 6 months, 8 months or something like that. I know when I do work in Fiji, we would take a tourist boat part of the way to get to this remote village that we were going to. And on the tourist boat, there's a lot of Australian tourists, and they were behaving the way young people do when they're on vacation and wearing bikinis. And that all seemed fine and totally natural, and I was completely comfortable with it. But by the time I'm on the return trip, I'm used to behaving in Fijian ways, sitting in particular ways, behaving in ways that felt respectful, given the local environment of the village. And then when I'm on the tourist boat, I'm kind of all uncomfortable already. And people seem to be behaving inappropriately, and I feel inclined to want to correct people. It doesn't take long to go away, but it's definitely an immediate discomfort you get because you've started to adapt to the local norms of the village. Research that I've done is, Fijians have these food taboos that they have during pregnancy and breastfeeding. And it seems like a peculiar thing to suddenly stop eating fish during that. And it might be something that a doctor might want to get rid of because he thinks it's bad for them. But when you study it in depth, it turns out it protects the locals from a toxin called Sanguetera toxin that's present in reef fish. And it can be passed to babies through breast milk or damage a fetus. And so it turns out to be an adaptive taboo that people themselves don't consciously understand, but it evolved over generations. And so if you tried to stamp that out without fully understanding it, you'd be making a big mistake because there's a kind of wisdom built into the local cultural practices.
Right. Apropos of change, one thing that fascinates me is that the Westerners are more logical. In addition to being more attuned to categories and the rules that apply to them, they also are better at logic. I mean, the Greeks invented logic, and in the West, that's been a constant strain. It's never gone away. And it's an alien way of thinking, for the most part, for Easterners. But, of course, it has advantages. I mean, just as they have cognitive advantages, we have the advantage there. We're more likely to analyze a situation and reach a conclusion that is logically correct. But that's not a hard trick to learn. And we actually find that if we look at people who are really thrown into the American culture, we look at Taiwanese, we have a study where we look at Taiwanese young people in their 30s, in Silicon Valley, and they're constantly rubbing shoulders with Americans. They're immersed in an American culture. After 10 years, they're not much different in their ability to analyze things than people who've been Americans all their lives. And only 10 years is sufficient, basically, to obliterate the difference in some of these cognitive tests. But I don't think it goes the other way around. The dialectical reasoning that underlies the greater wisdom of East Asians in some respect, that's just embedded in an orientation to the world. It's embedded in character. It's just I don't think it's as easy to learn. I mean, but I do feel like I have learned. I've see, gee, that's a better way of doing things. Do you find that you are influenced by the cultures that you study? Have you become a different person because of the people you've studied, Joe?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you pick up all kinds of little ways of being, and they even have expressions that I sometimes pick up. Things like, you know, oh, things just happen, or and so it goes, things like that. So I think that's very valuable.
Vonnegut fans also say, and so it goes.
Well, that was my translation of the Fijian, so I might be influenced by Vonnegut in the translation.
Do you speak Fijian?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't used it in a few years now, so it would be a bit rusty, but yeah.
That's pretty awesome. I bet you get really good rates when you go to hotels in Fiji.
unfortunately, the dialect that's spoken on the small islands that I live on is not the lingua franca of Fiji. So it's literally just this small island group that speaks it.
Oh, well, there you go. And there aren't many Fijian restaurants. I don't think I've ever seen one. So, I think the interesting thing, right, is it's not, there are some areas in which we're seeing that, you know, some cultures are just not particularly adaptive. And, you know, I don't think there's anything to be said particularly for an honor culture in the modern industrial world. But on the other hand, there are benefits to both the holistic way of thinking and the sort of more Western way of thinking. And, you know, I think you've seen this, that there's a cultural barring that goes back and forth. The West has become fascinated with meditation, has become fascinated with Eastern thought. And I think that, you know, slowly but surely, you know, both hemispheres are picking out a toolkit that sort of draws on the best of both. And that maybe we are evolving towards sort of a culture that is the synthesis of the two.
Boy, I hope that's true. And I more or less believe it.
But would you definitely say that there don't seem to be any particular benefits in the modern world to an honor culture?
Oh yeah, it creates huge problems. I mean, the American military is largely a Southern institution. Now, mm-hmm. They're much more likely to go into it, and you know, go charging around the world, you know, with that culture of honor. Stance can get you in trouble, and it's true in other Middle Eastern cultures. Many Middle Eastern cultures are cultures of honor, and that can get them in trouble. Get them being violent in situations where it's really not in their interests, let alone the interests of people they're aggressing toward.
Right, and I mean, because again, the Arabs are the descendants of the Bedouin, and the Bedouin were hurting people, so it was adaptive for them to have that honor culture. And so, you know, properly viewed, and this is something that we touched on the last time, you know, the conflict in the Middle East, you know, that has sort of developed, we really, in some sense, have these two honor cultures clashing. You know, the Southern-dominated U.S. military, you know, obviously partly driven by George W. Bush, who, even though he was born in Connecticut, seems to have internalized many of the norms of Texas. And then, you know, against, you know, this Arab honor culture. And so we're all really paying the price for these honor cultures in the modern world.
Yes, that's certainly true.
So I think that's the interesting thing as we start to look forward is that, yes, I don't know that, I mean, I would like to think that we killed political correctness here, but that certainly some cultures are more adaptive than others. There are good reasons why the cultures that we see today evolved, but they may not make sense in the modern world. You know, you have the East-West divide where they evolved out of different places, but they both are incredibly beneficial. And, you know, I was reminded as I was thinking about that of, you know, Martin Seligman talks about the differences between optimism and pessimism. And, you know, optimism has a whole bunch of benefits in terms of keeping you going, having you aspire and aim towards things, but it does make you delusional. And so pessimism, you know, gives you a much more realistic sense of how things are. And the solution is not to be either optimistic or pessimistic, but to trade between the two. And it would seem that it's the same between Eastern ways of thinking and Western ways of thinking. It's hopefully to dance back and forth between the two.
Well, that's what I would like to do. I'm not remotely there yet. I can't think holistically very well. But every now and then I
And so, hopefully we can now start to have a conversation where we start to really, you know, don't think of these in a personal way in terms of, you know, this being about me being a Southerner or being an Arab or being a Northerner or whatever, or being Chinese, but that we're able to look at what are the effects of these beliefs, what are the consequences, and is it that the system has some merits and some detractions, or is it just the system just doesn't make sense anymore in the modern world?
That's what we should do.
Yeah, absolutely. And then a mixture of like the sort of experimentation that you're talking about, Joe, in terms of different communities try different strategies out and let evolution decide. And then I do think that there is a place for, on certain values, you know, rationally understanding what is the helpful value, like embracing mistakes, but then recognizing that the way that those innovations diffuse is not a rational process, and therefore finding high status individuals, essentially role models. Yes, you know, Kim Kardashian, you do have a social responsibility. And, you know, making sure that those people are articulating the right values, or, you know, to create, you know, essentially a better, more productive society.
Yeah, maybe Kim can help you with disseminating some of those ideas about education that you mentioned.
Nothing would make me happier. And I mean that legitimately. I think that's the thing is that, you know, there, it's funny because, you know, I wish that Brian was here. I always wish that Brian was here. But the, you know, there really is like this real disconnect between a lot of entertainers don't feel qualified to talk about education. You know, often when they do talk about that stuff, they get shot down. And so there is this terrible disconnect where entertainers aren't able to inspire, you know, people to become more educated because, you know, they get punished for it and they don't feel particularly qualified. Often they don't feel very smart themselves. It's, again, it's one of these cultural things where it doesn't serve anybody. And of course it's like, okay, you know, does a particular celebrity know a lot about, you know, history or biology or anything like that? Not necessarily, but they do understand effective process. They do understand that you have to embrace your mistakes. You have to, you know, be honest and open and transparent. And so there are values that they can impart, even if they can't impart the specific domain, specific knowledge of, you know, oh, you know, the War of 1812 was fought over this.
Right.
So the other question that I had for you, Professor Nisbet, is we got a listener tweeted after your last interview and was asking, Thomas Sowell has really sort of driven the idea that a lot of black culture, or what we think of as African-American culture, is actually really Southern culture that they've internalized, from the speaking patterns to, you know, that honor of culture and violence, to attitudes to education, and that, you know, that may be a more helpful lens through which to see it, that it really shouldn't be seen through the lens of race, but through the lens of internalizing Southern norms, then added on to, you know, other norms that developed in response to slavery.
There's a wonderful book called The World They Made Together, and it's about Africans and Europeans in Virginia and how they adopted it. We have this notion that appropriation is a bad thing. My God, they were the English and the Africans were appropriating everything that looked good from the other culture. The English architectural ideas made more and from Africa made more sense in the South. Culinary ideas were more suited to the South than the African versions were than the English versions. The English gave the Africans harmony, and the Africans gave the English rhythm. It's wonderful. It shows how it was co-constructed. But apropos of the culture of honor of the set, that's certainly characteristic. I mean, I agree with everything that Sowell says there about that. I mean, black culture is astonishingly similar to wherever it is in America, to Southern culture, but on this question of the culture of honor, I believe that you would get the culture of honor if you put people down into an inner city situation. It would evolve automatically, because the whole point about why herding societies are the way they are is that the law is not around. herding societies tend to be very distributed, and you never were able to call 911 and get the sheriff. There's a North Carolina expression, every man is sheriff on his own hearth. When the law is not around, call for a pizza and call for a policeman and see which gets there first, an expression from the inner city, you have to defend yourself. You have to make it clear you're not going to take any guff from anybody, and a culture of honor would develop. But they did. They brought it with them, so they didn't have to invent it, but they would have.
Yeah, and so I think the archetypal example of, you know, a cultural adaptation which, you know, may have served certain people but is certainly hurting us all now is racism. Racism was not something that really seemed to be a fully fledged way of thinking before 1492. And, you know, I don't know if you guys are familiar with 1493, or I'm sure you're familiar with the original book rather than the original work rather than the popularizing. But the idea that, you know, the malarial line and the Mason-Dixon line are the same. And so that was the driving force that led to African slavery in the United States.
Yeah, I've heard about that. I don't know very much about it, but that is an interesting argument.
Yeah, so the idea is that, you know, in the North they had, indentured servants who were white who would come over. They worked freely and willingly. And then, you know, after, you know, 7 years, you know, their passage was paid for, and then they would be free men, and then they could go off and settle. And it was a very, very effective system in the North, but it never translated to the South because the South had malaria, and so, you know, people of European descent had no resistance to malaria, and so they would all die off. And the result was, you know, why not just enslave the native people as well, because they also died of malaria, and so they had to find the one population that had some resistance to malaria. And again, this is the sort of process that you talk about in The Secret of Our Success, is this was not some rational, intentional process. It's just sort of something that what worked ended up predominating, that evolutionary right. process. And so you find that there ends up being, you know, a lot of Africans who are imported in. And then, of course, you know, you have to, you know, there's also the fact that, you know, when two people look at each other in the eye and you're, you know, messing someone over, it becomes really hard to do. So the only way to be able to deal with that is to think of them as subhuman. And so that those sorts of beliefs would start to develop. And obviously the slave owner, who is really capable of believing that these people are less than human, feels much less compunction about enslaving hundreds, thousands of them, and therefore succeeds. Economically.
You know, yeah. A favorite idea of mine along those lines, and I'd be interested in hearing your view about it, Joe, is that kind of racism is much more common in North America than in South America. That is the move of deciding that the Africans are subhuman. It doesn't seem to be the case in Latin America. And I've always thought that could be the result. That could be a vice born of a virtue. I mean, all men are created equal. Oops, but I'm owning this other person. That's certainly not equality. How can I rationalize that? Oh, well, actually, he really is subhuman. He couldn't take care of himself. If it weren't for me, it's really a beneficial act. That kind of stance, that kind of racism, I've been told, is much less common in Latin America. But you've actually spent some time in Latin America, Joe, so you might
yeah,
have.
Yeah, so there's my sense is that's right, because in Latin America there's much more of a gradation. So, you know, you run continuously from kind of white people of Spanish descent through people who are a full range of mix of different peoples, all the way down to kind of aboriginal kind of indigenous populations.
So, I mean, you know, I mean, the institution of racism is really the peculiar institution of the United States. But again, in the same way that you were talking about earlier, Dick, once we really get into this and try to understand rationally why this would have been developed, right, in the same way as we try to understand why did the culture of honor developed, then we can start to have an honest conversation. And rather than just saying, you know, you guys are idiots for ever having believed this, there's a reason why this developed. We can understand those reasons, and we can now understand why it's not helpful in the modern world. And then we can begin to have a conversation about how do we actually move past it.
Right. Well, interestingly, it's very hard to to get rid of the culture of honor. It's only going to happen over a matter of generations. When I started studying this stuff, I discovered to my horror that I am a member of that culture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've always been more sensitive to insults than my Northeastern friends are. And I've gone into some situations where I ought to have gotten away from a call 911, and I've waded in because, you know, I'm a sheriff on my own hearth. Completely crazy. I mean, I've done crazy things, and I'm in general not that crazy, but they derive from that kind of culture of honor stance that you've got to take care of yourself.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Brian Callen Show, and I wish we could continue this conversation all day, but, you know, well, maybe we should, but another time. Listen, it's been my real honor to have Professor Henrich and Professor Nisbet on the show. Their books will be featured in the episode write-up, and I just can't thank you enough as an ordinary citizen of the world for the work that you're doing, and I hope you'll keep doing it and keep writing books, and who knows, maybe you two will write a book together someday, which is always my hope when I bring together two of my favorite thinkers.
Mm. Thanks, Hunter.
That'd be great for me. And this was a lovely conversation, I must say.
Well, I'm glad to hear it and glad to have provided a space for it, an agora, if you will. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening, and thank you again to our very thoughtful, esteemed, brilliant, and, you know, hopefully world-changing guests.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much, guys.
Bye-bye. Sure. Thank you.
This has been the Brian Callen Show without Brian Callen. I appreciate all of the tweets that are trying to suggest that we should have a coup and that we should strip Brian Callen's name from the show. But, you know, I mean, I'm looking at the kid right now because we're not allowed to podcast without a giant image of his face to inspire us. And, you know, this Brian Callen is one man who should never be photoshopped from history. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for thinking that my name should be on it, but never, never. Always the Brian Callen Show, even when he's only an ethereal spirit guiding my choices, as he always does. All right. Thanks so much, guys. Bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.